This is episode 314 of That Shakespeare Life. There's special behind-the-scenes content of the making of our show and insider Shakespeare extras, including over 150 additional episodes of our show not available on public listening platforms, all packed into the patrons area of our show. Find out more and sign up today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife and stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hello, I'm Tim Fitzhyam. I'm the creative director of the UK's oldest working theatre and the cultural officer for King's Lynn and West Norfolk. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
One of them is the room that is now claimed to be the birth room, the room where Shakespeare was born. That's on one side of the staircase. And on the other side of the staircase, there are two further rooms, which would have been also bedrooms.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
There's something uniquely fascinating about the place someone famous was born and grew up. As many of us travel long distances just for the chance to visit the birthplace of one of our heroes, we seem to recognize the importance of home as the foundation for future greatness. William Shakespeare's home is no exception, with thousands of people traveling to Stratford-upon-Avon every year to visit Shakespeare's birthplace. William Shakespeare's life journey began at his birthplace, making it an essential part of his history and the foundation of what he would go on to become. Here today to share with us the history of Shakespeare's birthplace as a building, how it was built, and what we know about how the property was used both before and after Shakespeare's residence there is our guest and author of the first book in the world specifically examining the history of this beautiful building, Richard Shook. Richard Shook is professor of drama at Queen's University Belfast, a visiting fellow at the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon, and the author of Shakespeare's House, published in 2023 by Arden Shakespeare. He has written A Short History of Shakespearean Performance, Not Shakespeare, Bardology and Burlesque in the 19th Century, and Shakespeare's Victorian Stage, all published by Cambridge University Press. He recently led the practice-based research project Performing Restoration Shakespeare in partnership with Shakespeare's Globe in London and the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. Hello, Richard. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life.
Thanks, Cassidy. It's great to be here.
Who built Shakespeare's birthplace originally? And is the size, construction, and architecture of the home typical of this period?
That's such an interesting question. In a way, no one built the house because, of course, at that time, there were no architects for private houses. You wouldn't design a house and ask someone to build it. So in a way, no one built it. We're talking probably around 1480, sort of a century before Shakespeare. There were generations that owned the house before him. So on one hand, nobody built it. On the other hand, everybody built it because it was built by local craftsmen from in and around Stratford. The wood came from the forest that rings Stratford. The stone came from the quarries nearby Stratford. And all the town's local artisans, stonemasons, bricklayers, painters, carpenters, joiners, glaziers, they all came in and did their bit. So building a house in a town like Stratford at that time had a real community feel. It was almost a public thing, not a private thing. And it looked like every other house because all houses looked pretty much the same, unless you were super rich and had something like a country estate, like Charlotte Park, where Shakespeare is said to have poached some deer. But townhouses, literally houses in the town, in a row, on the street, all look the same. And if you come to Stratford today or any other old English town or village, you'll see surviving houses from the 15th, 16th century that all kind of look the same. They were built on a stone foundation. They were sort of a mixture of timber pillars and, of course, floorboards and sort of plastering in between, that phrase wattle and daub. Underneath the plaster, you see sort of the beams going like this. And in between the beams is an infill of twigs and leaves and hair and animal dung that's covered by a paste. And that's kind of how you built the walls. And then you plastered that over. And every house from the street looks like that. And of course, they were all no more than three stories high, mostly two. There wasn't the technology to get any higher. And when you're building a house amongst a row of houses in a very small town, you're not going to stand out. You're going to fit in. So the house was completely typical of Stratford at the time. The reason this question is very interesting, because we have to think about, well, later on, when Shakespeare became famous, how did people react to him being born in a pretty ordinary town? And this kind of became a problem, that Shakespeare deserved a better house, a more extravagant, a fancier, a more ornate, even just a bigger house to be born in. But he wasn't. He was born in an average house to an average family in an average town. When they renovated the house in the 19th century, that's when things got interesting and they enlarged it, or rather they squashed together three separate structures to make it look like one big structure. So when the Victorians restored the house, they said, we're not really happy with Shakespeare's ordinary house. Let's give him something like a manor house, something really impressive. We just don't like Shakespeare being born in an ordinary house, but he was.
Now, you mentioned that it was constructed somewhere around 1480, and that is, as you mentioned, several years before Shakespeare was born in 1564. So when exactly did John and Mary Shakespeare first come to own the property?
There are some records about this, a little bit of speculative, but some is in the records. And so remember, you're right to say 1564, that's when Shakespeare was born. His father was renting that house by 1552. He had finished his apprenticeship in Stratford as a glover. He was starting his own career, making his way in local politics. So he was, you know, master of his own household, you know, living under his own authority, as it were. So he had his own house. And it was, in all likelihood, that house on Henley Street by 1552. We know that by 1556, he owned it, along with another property on nearby Greenhill Street. The records are a little shaky, but that's the inference to be drawn from this. So in the 1550s, first as a tenant, and then a few years later, he buys it. And then in 1556, he marries Mary Arden from Wilmcote, and they live together in the house on Henley Street. And then 8 years later, Shakespeare is born.
Now, was the original building used as both a home and a business for John Shakespeare? You mentioned that he finished his apprenticeship before he bought this property. Was he working out of the home as well as living there?
He was, and he was a glover, and he worked from home. That was not unusual for the time. He didn't have a shop on the high street in Stratford. There was a market every Thursday where he would have a stall, but that was just one day a week. He made gloves and sold gloves out of his workshop in the house on Henley Street. And it's a largish room. On the ground floor, as the Brits say, on the first floor, as the Americans say. If you're looking at the house, it's on the far right-hand side, and it's a largish room, and only one thing was done in that room. That was John Shakespeare's work. He and his apprentices, which may or may not have included William, that was their space. They also worked a bit outside when they had sort of chemicals and sort of noxious fumes from the animal hide. So in the back of the workshop, you know, they kind of stripped leather and did the beveling and the stitching, making gloves and also belts and wallets and leather purses. So that's what they did in the back of the workshop room. And in the front, there was sort of a hutch door. So that kind of opened on the top half. And then there would be almost like a tray that would come out from the window onto the street. So he would display goods on Henley Street to sort of attract the passing trade. So he worked inside his house. That was not at all unusual. And it kind of tells us how the house was divided along gender lines in terms of who did what during the day. You know, so, you know, one half of the house is John Shakespeare and his male apprentices in the glove trade. That's one end of the house. And the other end of the house is Mary Shakespeare, her daughters, and probably a serving maid or two, basically looking after the food and the clothing and all the domestic routines and tasks that need to be looked after. But people have their own spaces in their houses. And we talked today about work-life balance. It's an old, old issue, right? Shakespeare's father was working from home. There was no way of getting around that.
Well, tell us more about the interior of the house. How many fireplaces did it have? Was there a kitchen inside the house? And perhaps most interestingly, do we know which bedroom William Shakespeare would have slept in?
There were six rooms in the house that Shakespeare lived in. On the lower floor, there was the workshop on one side. In the center was what is called the hall, meaning not a corridor or passageway, but a hall in the formal sense. That was the main room for entertaining and dining, telling stories, playing games, where the family prayed. That was the sort of central room for living. And then a parlor next to it, which is sort of a secondary space and would be also used for some food preparation. So those were the three rooms on the lower floor. On the upper floor were three bedrooms. One of them is the room that is now claimed to be the birth room, the room where Shakespeare was born. That's on one side of the staircase. And on the other side of the staircase, there are two further rooms, which would have been also bedrooms. And then, of course, those rooms you can see in the birthplace today, they are open to the sort of the loft space. And there are some architectural records that suggest in Shakespeare's time that was also an open space. There were not floorboards. If there had been, they could have used that for further sleeping, probably for the apprentices or the servants, wouldn't have been very, very comfortable, or for storage. So there was a lot of space to do different things. So six rooms, three on the lower floor, three on the upper floor. Each had a fireplace. I mean, that was the kind of the wonderful thing by this time, that the technology was there so that every room could be reasonably warm. So six rooms, six fireplaces. And of course, the fireplaces are stacked. So you would have two fireplaces for each chimney, if you see what I mean. The kitchen, there was a kitchen in the parlor and a pantry in the cellar where they would store dry goods, you know, dried fruits that they would want to keep for the winter, seeds, grains, that sort of thing. But there was not a kitchen in our sense of a kitchen, obviously not a refrigerator or a freezer, but there wasn't even a sink because there was no running water. So when we think of kitchen, there was none of that in Shakespeare's time. There was a fireplace, a hearth, the large one, which you can see, which was really the heart of the kitchen, where you would do your cooking, where you would stir the pot over the flame. Food preparation, the other thing we think of as happening in the kitchen, was quite dispersed. If it was really messy, I mean, if you were dressing meat or gutting a fish, or if you were shelling peas, you'd probably want to do that outside or in an outbuilding rather than in, you know, one of the nicer rooms in your house. And again, you know, what we think of as kitchen cupboards, that was in the cellar and probably also in some of the outbuildings. So there was the main hearth that was tended during the day where food was cooked, But a lot of what we think of as sort of kitchen activity, food preparation and food storage, was dispersed inside and out. And of course, they didn't eat in what we would call the kitchen or the parlor where the fireplace was. They ate in the main room, in the hall. So it's interesting to think about, you know, our rhythms and routines of home life, of domestic life, and how they don't always align with what we know about how Shakespeare's family lived.
Did John and Mary Shakespeare live in the house until their deaths? And when did their children inherit the home?
So John Shakespeare lived until 1601. In 1601, he was living there. His wife was living there. Possibly, we don't really know, but possibly his daughter, Joan Hart, that's her married name. She was married to a hatter named William Hart. They didn't have much money. William Hart was sued for debt around 1600, and they had a few children. So John and Mary might have had their daughter, their son-in-law, and some of their grandchildren also living with them. We don't know for sure. So 1601, John Shakespeare dies. The other side of the house, they're living in a fairly small space. The other side of the house has been rented out as an inn, the Swan Inn, to a man named Lewis Hickox. So John Shakespeare dies. William Shakespeare, as the eldest son, inherits the house automatically, not Mary Shakespeare, goes right to William Shakespeare. But he does not live there. He never lived there. I mean, when he left one time. We don't know exactly when, but he never came back to live there. He was living in New Place by then. So he owns the house in 1601, but he doesn't live there. His mother, who lived until 1608, I think, could have gone on living there. That would have been a reasonable thing to do. She'd been living there for decades. But it might also be the case that Shakespeare and his wife, Anne Hathaway, said, well, she's on her own now. She's getting on a bit. You know, let her come live with us because we live in a new place, a much bigger house. So it would stand to reason, though we don't know, that Mary Arden, Mary Shakespeare, when her husband died, moved into William Shakespeare's house in New Place. But we don't know. What we do know is that by the time Shakespeare died in 1616, by this time, of course, both his parents are dead. His sister Joan and her husband, though he dies about the same time as Shakespeare, and her children are living in the birthplace. And in Shakespeare's will, he says, my daughter Susanna inherits it because she's my oldest surviving child, but I will let my sister Joan continue to live there and pay a peppercorn rent, a nominal rent of about 12 shillings. So it gets quite complicated. And it's often the person who owns the house is not living there, but they're letting somebody else in the family live there. It gets a little bit dicey.
What does this mean for the property itself after there were no more Shakespeare relatives to inherit the property?
That's a fascinating question. It's kind of sad and tragic to think that Shakespeare's direct line died out two generations later with his granddaughter, she said Elizabeth Barnard, who had no children. So nobody to leave it to. So she dies in the Restoration in the 1660s. So what, 50 years? 50 years after Shakespeare died. And she has nobody to leave it to. But remember, the Harts, the descendants of Shakespeare's sister, and therefore Elizabeth Barnard's cousins, this family drama gets very intense. The Harts are living in the house in the 1660s. They are still living there. They've been living there for decades. Elizabeth Barnard dies. What happens to the house? In her will, she leaves it to Thomas Hart, her second cousin, who has been living in that house and whose family has been living in that house for decades and decades. So the family now moves formally into the possession of the Harts, Shakespeare's nearest surviving relatives. And they own the house until 1806, when they sell it to Anne and Thomas Court. And that, after centuries, is when the birthplace finally moves out of Shakespeare's extended family. But his descendants, through his sister, Joan Hart, lived there for a very long time.
In his book, Shakespeare's House, A Window into His Life and Legacy, Richard takes a look at the 400 plus years of history behind Shakespeare's birthplace, including the story that P.T. Barnum of Barnum and Bailey Circus almost bought the house and had planned to move it to the U.S. in the 19th century. You can explore why that didn't happen and all the fascinating turns of life that Shakespeare's birthplace has seen inside this amazing book that we will link to in the show notes for today's episode. Of course, Richard, compiling a book like yours required a great deal of research, I'm certain, which makes you uniquely positioned to offer us some of the best recommendations when it comes to learning more about the history of Shakespeare's birthplace. Where would you recommend that we start to learn more?
Well, I would absolutely recommend that you visit Shakespeare's birthplace in Stratford-upon-Avon. It's run by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, a fantastic Shakespeare heritage organization. They look after it well, and there's a wonderful collection there. So I would say there's come and see the house. If you can't, there are plenty of videos on YouTube where you can take a virtual tour of the house. But to do justice to your question, if you want to read about the house, I have to say, with some degree of modesty, that the book I've written, Shakespeare's House, is the only book on the history of Shakespeare's birthplace. That's why I wrote it. So there is no other book. However, I would like to recommend to you all two books related to the topic, to know something about Shakespeare and his family in Stratford, and something about the phenomenon of houses where writers lived. So the first book I want to recommend to you is called The Private Life of William Shakespeare by Lena Orlin, who's a professor of English at Georgetown. It's published by Oxford a couple of years ago. And she really dug into the archives in Stratford. And one of the interesting things she found is that we know more about John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father, than we do about William Shakespeare. So if you want to know a lot about Shakespeare's family in Stratford, Lena Orlin's book, The Private Life of William Shakespeare, is a great book. Another book I would recommend to you is a book called The Author's Effects, E-F-F-E-C-T-S, The Author's Effects on Authors' Homes Museums. It's by Nicola Watson, who's at the Open University in the UK. And it's a wonderful book on the phenomenon of houses where authors lived being turned into museums, like where Walter Scott lived, where Emily Dickinson lived in Amherst, Massachusetts, and of course, where Shakespeare lived. So it's just culturally, it's a very interesting idea that readers would like to visit the place where an author grew up. And why would they like to do that? And what are they expecting to find? And what would make that kind of pilgrimage or visit worthwhile? So Nicola Watson's book, The Author's Effects, is a great source. And I love the pun in the title, because effects means, on the one hand, personal effects, because the best thing about an author's house, if they're a fairly recent author, is the house is filled with their personal effects. You can see the desk where Emily Dickinson wrote, but also the author's effect upon the reader, upon us. So it's a very clever title. But those are my top picks.
These are excellent suggestions, and we will link to Richard's book as well as these others for you to check out in the show notes for today's episode. So stay tuned for the URL for where to find those. Now, Richard, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
Well, it's good that Shakespeare's already included.
Of course, we couldn't leave him out.
Too obvious an answer. I would pick, I think, a book that a lot of your viewers and listeners will know, The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, which then, of course, became a film with Christian Slater and Sean Connery. And I love this book, long though it is. because it's a book about books, and it's a book about how dangerous books can be. And right now we're seeing that in the headlines. People finding danger, feeling threatened, getting upset about books. So it's in a moment like that that I want to go back to Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose.
I think that's an excellent selection for your desert island pick. And I'm going to go and look this movie up now because I hadn't heard of this. And I think I have to see it because those are two of my favorite actors.
There you go.
What's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
In an almost complete change of course, I'm writing a book about Stephen Sondheim, the great Broadway composer and lyricist. But I would like to point out that there's a Shakespearean trace even in Stephen Sondheim's musicals. You know, he wrote the lyrics for West Side Story, which is, of course, a version of Romeo and Juliet. And he was the composer and the lyricist for a musical called Assassins about U.S. presidential assassins, which premiered in about 1990. And one of the characters is John Wilkes Booth, who was an actor and assassinated Lincoln in Ford's Theater. And there's a wonderful scene where Booth is dying. And it's essentially Sondheim's version of Hamlet's death when Hamlet says, "Tell my story." He has John Wilkes Booth basically assume the role of Hamlet and ask for his story to be told. So switching from Shakespeare to Sondheim, it's been really interesting to see how Shakespeare is always finding his way into other cultural forms, even Broadway musicals.
His influence is everywhere. Thank you everywhere. So much, Richard Shook, for being here today to walk us through the history of Shakespeare's birthplace, which played such an important role in the life of William Shakespeare and the influence he was able to have for centuries to come. This has been a fun conversation and a neat look literally inside Shakespeare's house. I appreciate you being here to share it with us.
My pleasure, Cassidy. Thank you for inviting me.
I've gathered up visuals and artifacts that go along with our conversation today so you can see some of the things that we speak about, as well as my own photographs of my trip to Stratford-upon-Avon when I got to visit Shakespeare's birthplace myself, so you can see some of those in-person images of the various rooms and artifacts that Richard is sharing with you today. All of these things are packed in the show notes along with direct links to the resources that Richard recommends you check out if you would like to learn more about the history of Shakespeare's birthplace. Find all of these things at CassidyCash.com/episode 314. That's CassidyCash.com/EP314. If you'd like to go beyond the episode to really explore inside that Shakespeare life, then consider joining us on Patreon. Patrons get to see behind-the-scenes content of the making of our show and listen to over 150 additional episodes not available on public listening platforms. There's also video versions of the podcast, printable educator resources, including lesson plans and worksheets, along with a collection of digital history activity kits that let you try out some of the games, recipes, and crafts you learn about here on the show, right at home or in your classroom. And of course, all of these resources coordinate with specific episodes of our podcast and with Shakespeare's plays. If this sounds exciting to you, then find out more and join us today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learn something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.